Chapter 14, Zwei Rechnungen ab. Sam Oakenhurst had seen the plane once before but was surprised. Jack Karakwazian was mindlessly resentful of its appearance. He grumbled of vulgar waste. Mr. Karakwazian's prejudice was confirmed when, under his angry scrutiny, a white man pushed back the cabin panel, cheerfully waving to their boat before returning to his controls and taxiing close enough for the two men to throw him a line, allowing him to move from wing to boarding gate in a few elegant steps. Jack Karakwazian was struck by the pungent, chilly wealth of the air and breathed in deeply as if it might be his last. Stripping off his pigskin flying gloves, the pilot offered a manicured and effeminate hand. "Good afternoon, gentlemen, I am obliged to you. I'm Rudy von Beck. I believe my sister-in-law is your captain." It was only then that Sam Oakenhurst realized Rose von Beck had married a white. The possibility had simply not occurred to him. There was an awkward moment or two before he shook the visitor's hand. He had forgotten how to judge his fellow creatures by skin or sex. He had admitted this more than once to a doubting Jack Karakwazian. Mr. Oakenhurst did not seem to notice their visitor's astonishment at the set and length of his fingers. "I guess the Rose is glad to see a relative at this particular moment." "I thought I'd lost you." Noting that Jack Karakwazian made no attempt to shake his hand, Count von Beck looked around. "It's pretty rough going in these parts, eh?" Jack Karakwazian nodded. "We've had a few upsets lately." He asked the white man where he had come from. "Muhrenberg, most recently. Do you know it?" Von Beck seemed heedless of Mr. Karakwazian's frank disapproval. Jack Karakwazian said that he had spent 6 or 7 months in Europe as a youth and found it depressing. He wasn't sure what he had hated most, the poverty or the climate. He had been to Muhrenberg, but he did not seem to remember it especially. Von Beck seemed amused. "Well, most Europeans are rather proud of Muhrenberg, even if her architecture is a little extravagant." Jack Karakwazian had found the buildings hideously and fussily barbaric and the streets only marginally cleaner than the inhabitants. "Ruins and beggars," he thought. "I have not had the privilege of your perspective and familiarity," he said. Then the Rose came glowing down from her cabin and embraced him. "Rudy!" Von Beck began to unbutton his flying jacket. "Do you have anything to eat, old girl?" Jack Karakwazian could not bring himself to accompany them to the dining table. He remained on deck, smoking his pipe and studying the birds. Events had grown too strange for him. He felt deeply uneasy. Neither Sam nor the Rose had said anything of a plane or its pilot. He was almost convinced of his companion's mental instability. He was a fool for getting caught up in this. The sun set over the lagoon and he looked back at a saloon lit by warm orange lamps, by a cool silver moon, and he felt lonelier than he ever had felt before. He turned up his collar against the cold, but did not go to his cabin. For a long time he stood listening to the sounds from the water, reassured by the familiar calls. Until recently, his habit of following his professional code had served him well. That code had allowed him to make his way fairly comfortably through a harsh but largely unfamiliar world. One he had rarely questioned. Now his world grew steadily unfamiliar. While the physical disruptions were as nothing to a Yugador of Jack Karakwazian's experience, the rest, like these arrogant whites, was disconcerting. Mr. Karakwazian was used to knowing who his friends were and to picking his associates. The Rose should have warned him to expect these events. His very identity was threatened. He was distressed to realize how much of his inner life was influenced by the actions of the outer world. He had always tended to be solitary. He wished he could have made this journey alone. His love for Kalinda de Vero had led him to agree to the Rose's plans and engage in her adventures. Had she used his love to manipulate him, as she manipulated Sam Oakenhurst? For most of his life, Jack Karakwazian had lived the disciplined life of an adept, according to a few certainties and principles. but he had already made a nonsense of his honour once. Consequently, he had lost Colinda de Vero. Now that everything he revered was in question, he did not know if he had manhood or character enough to survive. Pulling himself together, Mr. Caraquazian decided to seek out Sam Oakenhurst as soon as possible and put some questions to his friend. He trusted Mr. Oakenhurst to answer as honestly as he could. Meanwhile, he let the hope engulf him as he told himself their story of the gold stains and his encounter with the brothers Berger and their pa in the Breed Papoose. He recalled her leave-taking, how she cupped the drops of his blood in her hands before carrying it into the stain. "If you stay, I shall not return. You're growing old here, Jack." He remembered his game with Ox Berger and what the man had done for him. He had never met a more generous nor a better player. Mr. Caraquazian had learned to question the pride he took in his honour and his altruism, but Ox had taught him to accept another's forgiveness. Jack Caraquazian told himself his story and Colinda's. He was preparing to come to her an honest man. And now, he thought resentfully, the rose was his only hope. Chapter 15. Kein Talent zum Geierfraß. Er fand keines. Count von Beck called over his shoulder to the rose as he settled himself behind his instruments. They had been speaking that harsh language ever since they left the paddle steamer. Jack Caraquazian thought the seat's luxury almost obscene, but he had to admit an extraordinary sense of security. The interior of the aeroplane had felt cramped as they brought their luggage abroad. Now it seemed spacious. The decorations were intricate. Lavish blues, yellows, golds, greens, and reds. Some European notion of the Egyptian original. The garish vulgarity seemed appropriate to the vehicle. On the other side of the aircraft, Sam Oakenhurst's strange fingers explored details of brass and chrome. "This whole thing's a work of art." He had always been fascinated in what most people saw as the extravagant expression of a corrupt and degenerate civilization in its final years, before its descent into mere savagery. Paul Reeve, almost certainly. The cost of materials must have been enormous. The Machinois possess great collections of these things, you know, in their bunkers. Most of their capital is invested in art. Jack Caraquazian had little curiosity about the Machinois or their taste. Like this bizarre white art, it related to nothing he understood or felt at ease with. He feared he lacked the imagination for the rose's game of time. Sensing his friend's mood, Sam Oakenhurst stopped his enthusiastic explorations and came to sit down. "It ain't scary once you get there, Jack. No scarier than anywhere else." Sam Oakenhurst had explained everything he could to Jack Caraquazian. He swore the rose was not deceiving them. Apart from his own instincts, he trusted the word of the Machinois. They had once played the game, but now chose not to. Though weary of the second ether themselves, they assured him she spoke only truth. "We'll know how to play when we get there, Jack. It's the same as the games we're used to, only with more scale changes. Should be easy for you." "I doubt that, Sam." "Well," Mr. Oakenhurst persisted, "I've had a taste or two of playing, Jack. There's nothing to beat the thrill, the way your blood quickens. Even the likes of us, Jack. It makes you young. Believe me, Jack, the rose is on the square. You'll get what you want out of this, as will I." With a slight gesture of his fingers, Jack Caraquazian acknowledged his friend's concern. "I guess I'm used to relying on a few basic rules, Sam. I always saved complexity for my work. I always wanted my private life to be simple. Maybe I should have let a little more uncertainty in. I guess that's how I really lost Colinda." "Maybe," said Sam Oakenhurst. "I don't know. Jack Caraquazian and Colinda de Vero were probably the best gamblers on the continent." Mr. Oakenhurst hated to see his admired friend experiencing regret. You don't have to do any of this. You just go to her. You deserve that. Play later when you feel like it. But Jack, I want to play bad. It's what I've been training for. I just want to taste the second ether. Know the characters in the game. Maybe get a link with Pearl Peru herself. Now, but do you think I'm crazy? You always followed your enthusiasms through, Sam, Jack Karaquazian began to grin. You can have Kalinda without playing the game, Jack. She hasn't played it. She'll think no less of you. Well, I want a taste of it too, Sam. I don't have your obsession with it, but I do have a little curiosity. I'd like to find out where I stand as a player. Find the centre of all this, maybe. Or maybe there ain't a centre, Jack. Not in the way you mean. Maybe not. Maybe I'll just have to make one for myself. Next time I see Mrs. DeVero, I want to be pretty sure of my bearings. You're scared she won't want you? Mainly that's what I'm scared of, Mr. Karaquazian agreed. Chapter 16, Ace Among Aces. Pale King's conventional gambit level 990. Open, first player 1 to E, quadrant, slide at yellow, slide at green, turn left to parrot. Cross yellow, cross green, hover on 55, proceed to lilac. Second player 2, downscale to 10, but slice. 7 and cross, slice to west quadrant. Slide on green, cross on yellow, turn right to lizard. Slide green, slide yellow, hover on 55. Maintain. 1, up to 19, and turn on GGF to yellow 4000, down to 7 and cross. 2 to orange plus and reverse into spiral. XX switch to runic 66, release and tap up to 10. 1, radical close scale. Slide on green, cross on yellow, maintain. 2, fold on 77, green slide, yellow slide, orange slide, down to 5. Thus towards achievement of 040 to fix. Chapter 17. Pass des Verderbens. Until he looked out of the porthole, Jack Karaquazian did not realize they had left the familiar world. What he saw was a mass of roughly circular dark blue shapes which grew smaller and lighter as they moved towards a pale yellow haze. The effect was of peering down an endless tunnel. He turned away and saw the rose at the plane's controls, a black figure against the pulsing red and orange kaleidoscope forward. The far porthole revealed an identical phenomenon of blue circles at which Sam Oakenhurst eagerly stared. Jack Karaquazian became aware of the engines grumbling on the upper wings. The vibrations increased as the plane dipped to enter a jagged shard of faded green and from there soared above a field of enormous poppies. He felt as though he had been absorbed by a bracket. The light and colour had a familiar, soft vividness. There were no shadows. Everything glowed with equal intensity as if from inner fire. Steered with extraordinary sureness, certain to have been this way before, the flying boat banked and then nosed into a sky coruscating with multifaceted moonstones. Now he understood how she had come by her reputation on the Missouri. His teeth were like metal. They ached. He was glad he had not eaten with the others. Bile leapt into his mouth. He heard the rose laughing, saw Count von Beck get up from the co-pilot seat and stroll past him towards the stern. Sam Oakenhurst took von Beck's place. Jack Karaquazian watched while faces formed in harsh purple tapestries. They were insect faces. He found them abominable. Russet oak leaves becoming brown streaked with silver fanned out and dismissed the faces. He breathed the scent of lilies. Sometimes, he heard the rose say, I think we're shown a glimpse of the beginning, but maybe it's only the end. It seemed to Jack Karaquazian that the plane banked again and began to spin. He became dizzy and the plane dissolved. He stood naked and defiant against the firmament, his flesh fierce with brazen light. His destiny charted before his eyes, his spirit full of song. He was possessed of a noble certainty of purpose, ready to make his own way to the second ether and choose his role. He was consumed with a vibrant sense of physical well-being. Easy, Jack. The plane's engine slowed and there was a sound of rushing air as she began to descend. Jack Kerkwazian wiped mist from the porthole and saw recently mown wheat fields, vineyards, rooftops and chimneys. And then the flying boat was dropping towards a large artificial lake flanked by totems carved in marble and granite, figures of boys and women in absurdly stylized poses, the old pseudo-realism of a white civilization which in its day had ruled half the globe before collapsing under the weight of its own self-deception. Beyond this ornamental lake were the crenellated walls and towers of a barbarian city, its domes, steeples, and votive columns rising high into an early morning sky. The plane banked, straightened, coughed again and hit the water smoothly with a loud thump which shocked both men. Up from the rear came a jaunty Rudy von Beck in holiday clothes, a pale grey suit and lilac accessories, including the traditional topper of his tribe. He carried a carpet bag. It's a wedding, he said apologetically. I'm the best man. Goodbye, my friends. He shook hands with them both as he paused by the main door in the middle of the fuselage. He would pass through this onto the lower wing. He would take the inflatable on a cord. They would retract the boat as soon as he reached the shore. I'm leaving you with the finest ether pilot since Renark of the Rim. You are lucky men. Which is why I guess we're here. Sam Okenhurst was warmer to the white man than Jack Kerkwazian was able to be. We'll be seeing you, Rudy. Von Beck went forward to embrace the rose. They spoke in that same guttural language full of granite vowels and steel consonants, which Mr. Kerkwazian believed resembled the tongue used by bull baboons battling for kingship. All those European dialects sounded the same, which was doubtless why Europeans preferred Arabic as their common language. Watching Count von Beck rowing himself rapidly toward the bank, Jack Kerkwazian took deep breaths of the autumn air. The light was red-gold and gently fading. Even as the sun rose upon the flashing copper and tiles of Nuremberg's roofs, and gave the whole city the gaudy grandeur of a carnival. It was impossible to see any beauty von Beck and the rose claimed for the settlement. Momentarily, Mr. Kerkwazian wondered why, at the last moment, Sam Okenhurst had handed von Beck a folded sheet of paper, probably a letter. He sought desperately for his bearings. He had no time to gather himself, to take stock of what might be happening, to recover control. The rose watched von Beck through the plane's forward windshield. You are wondering, Sam, why I would marry someone like that. Rudy is almost the opposite of his brother, though both had courage. He has rescued me more than once. There was no escape from that stasis until he arrived, and from there we shall easily fly through the autumn stars up into the Grail. I know the way. And from there, thought Sam Okenhurst with a sensation in his groin which threatened to overwhelm him and yet did not seem entirely sexual, it will be a short step to Pearl Peru and the Game of Time. He kissed his soulmate and dreamed of extravagant adventure. Chapter 18. High Noon in Holtville von Ringo Hurricane. Chapter 18 is just a playbill, a flyer for what appears to be a commedia dell'arte. And it's got a little personal note scrawled on the bottom. It says, "The Morality and Plurality of Nature, an Alchemical Treatise," by Dr. Jeremiah Cornelius, M.B., late of the Universities of Prague and Alexandria, London, the Scientific Press, Bow Street, E, 1867, author of The Variety of Choice in Nature, The Moral Purpose of Choice, An Ordering of Chaos, The Retreat of Memory, etc., etc., with Captain Billy Bob in China by Warwick Colvin, Captain Billy Bob and the Electric Kettle by Warwick Colvin, Captain Billy Bob's Radio Oven by Warwick Colvin, Captain Billy Bob Meets Professor Pop by Warwick Colvin, Professor Pop and His Speed Shell by Warwick Colvin, Professor Pop Trapped in the Boom Whap by Professor by Warwick Colvin, etc., etc. And the personal note says, Dear Von Beck, above is my want list of books which you might find in Muhrenberg while browsing. Don't look especially, mon ami, but thanks for the offer. Votre paid. And then it's signed S.A. Chapter 19, Das Rote Universum. By the time we had found the Grail again and ridden effortlessly up the scales to the heart of the second ether, the Rose had convinced Jack of his sanity. Both he and I were almost through vomiting. Jack says to me that I was right. The beauty of it is enough to die for. We don't have to die, Jack, says the Rose. That's the real beauty of it. We have a chance, she says. And we've damned all to lose given the odds against us. Change the nature of time and you alter the terms of the human condition. I understood better than Jack what she meant. They were trying to make some sort of just world. They were playing from faith with the power of their trained wills, given their best in an effort to create an ideal. From somewhere the Rose had obtained coordinates and a destination. We could rendezvous with our chosen patrons in the lower colour fields where Cuttlefish and her paramour was being played, with all the characters present. Fearless Frank Force, Capitan Chaos, Manly Mark Mail, Little Fanny Fun, Corporal Pork, Carl Capital, Straight Arrow, and the others for the singularity. Opposing them were Captain Billy Bob and all her famous Chaos Engineers, Capricorn Schultz, and some who were entirely for themselves. With the legendary Spammer Gain, Pearl Peru was one of the few truly neutral adventurers. But Pearl's weakness was for Bully Bob, believed dead in the blue ice, searching for the lost universe of Ko-O-Ko. And this distracted Pearl from following her conscience, which told her to go to the aid of the Spammer Gain, whose quest for her fishlings had led that mighty benignity into the power of the original insect. Jack was still uneasy about playing in the company of so many whites, particularly taking on a white's role. I told him his distaste was a weakness which would do him no good in the second ether, where issues of blood had long since ceased to concern us. He agreed. To make a judgment according to race or gender is ungentlemanly and uncivilized, Sam, I know that. But that white bassy boy freak still gives me the willies. Von Beck had not seemed a freak to me. Perhaps that was because we were all freaks there, save Jack himself. The Rose, for instance, was only half human, and maybe me too. I'm way out of my depth again, says Jack. The same as when I lost Kalinda. It's colouring everything. Now wait until you're playing, I told him, then you'll feel good again. You'll understand. But he was not entirely convinced. Twice in the last little while he had lost to me and the Rose at the brackets. We had been stunned. Jack had treated the events fatalistically as if they were expected. I told him this was a bad time to start getting demoralised. He agreed. At this rate, I said, you'll be taken out of the game in the opener. It was as if he was deliberately trying to sour his luck. And his luck, I said, was the best thing we had on our side. I wasn't falling. Only as Jack weakened on us did I realise just how much we were depending on his famous luck. But luck could go in seconds and never come back in a lifetime. We all knew that. Both the Rose and I were getting scared that Jack's luck wasn't around anymore. We could have one of the walking wounded on our hands. I talked to reminding him of his own stories, of his legendary fights and risks, his unprecedented winnings and extraordinary losses, of how he had faced five bigwigs fixing to bushwhack him down on the Colorado just outside Austin, how he had been hanged and never even gotten a bruised neck. In Baton Rouge, he had beaten old Mum's Bonchance at her own game. She had ruled the tables for as long as anyone remembered, and Jack Caraquazian challenged her and won. There was no one like Jack Caraquazian. Al Karim in the whole of the States. With his Marrakesh training and his true Egyptian blood, he was the very model of intellectual Africa. Independent, self-disciplined, refusing the obvious and partial solution in favour of the whole, conscious of the common good, courteous to ladies and his social inferiors, and able, if called upon, to defend his people and his honour to the death. He was, I reminded him, the inspiration of 1,000 outstanding Ouagadors on his adopted continent alone. He was courted by the most beautiful woman. Anyone who had ever sat at the flat table with him boasted of it. Why was he upset by the experience of being a piece in the game rather than controlling everything? You're too used to knowing all the moves ahead of time, I told him. You'll have to take this thing move by move, as she comes, at least for a while. He asked me if you ever got used to it enough to read the currents of the game without thinking. I said I knew this happened. The Rose could do it, but you couldn't get too experienced at it. There was a point where you lost spontaneity. That was when you gave up or retired. If you refused to admit your condition, you lost, sometimes instantly, and were no more. Extinguished? I guess so, I said. I only have a hazy idea. I knew a little more than I admitted. I had trembled, after all, as the tongues of the Machinois relived their ecstatic moments at the game of time. So, baby, they had taught me how to discover the second ether on the path of pain. You had to be fully alive to survive the second ether and play the game. But I had followed the wide red paths between the universes, borne above them on wings of pure silver and calling out the songs which took me through a confusion of grids and vapours, following the long winding roads dusty into the summer's heat, between the rolling wooded hills or coursing into the heart of stars, flying naked against unguessable miles of dark blue silk and green clouds and the smell of warm rain threatening a storm. You are alive and free in every element, I added. You're fully alive, aware of every individual vein and organ, every blood cell. You have the whole multiverse at your disposal. You can go where you like and be whom you wish to be at any scale you choose. Yeah, but not if you play the game of time, Jack grinned. If you play the game, you do what Pearl Peru should do, or what Carl Capital would do. You must obey the rules, however subtle. You must play their story and not your own. No, I said, you play your own story through theirs. That is what the great players do. That is the secret of winning at the game of time. You must hope to put your own stamp upon the tale, to leave it permanently altered. She is of the just, as am I. We are hoping to bend the multiverse to our will and destroy the rule of the beast. It's in their logic and their alchemy as it is in ours. Jack said that it was superstitious blanco nonsense and was disbelieving. Cheap, fairground mumpo-jumpo, the kind those poor damned whiteys thrive on. You'd be surprised what you can learn from their mumpo-jumpo. I was angry with his deliberate ignorance. They have an old wisdom, Jack. It didn't do them much good, he said. I saw no further point in talking to him and went forward again. I could feel those gorgeous archetypes down in the lower colour fields. I longed to hear the voice of Pearl Peru. I could sense them almost as strongly as they sensed me. They radiated an astonishing aura. Mighty heroes and heroines playing out their lives with an intensity never captured even on the original V. I had relived Pearl's early adventures. As human as myself then, she had sailed upon the oceans of Venus, trading between the soiled worlds and the fresh, knowing only slow, succulent sensations. Lured into the limbo on the edge of the second ether by a powerful demon, all that remained of an earlier hero called Ku-Aga. Pearl had been forced to play crude games and make humiliating moves at remote provincial termini. The demon had inhabited her body so that he might gain the second ether and rejoin the game of time. But Pearl had learned her lessons and determined to make her own mark on that famous game. She aspired to become a major player in the struggle between chaos and singularity, but remain neutral. She would earn her place in the Pantheon not by joining one side or the other, but by her daring trade journeys and explorations. So she became the merchant venturer, Pearl Peru, having exorcised the last of Ku-Aga. Her story grew to be an integral part of the larger saga, the Tale of the Fishlings, itself part of an even larger saga known as the Fifth Lay. The stories were endless, but fell eventually into familiar patterns. The trick was to anticipate or provide innovation. It could come from anywhere and from anyone. And that was what I tried to tell Jack. It was no good being suspicious of the unfamiliar when everything was strange. I was never at any point actually alarmed by Jack's lassitude and resistance, though I pretended to be. I knew he was the best of us. I knew that once engaged with the game of time, he would play like the professional he was. At least while his luck held. But I knew I had to play the best I'd ever played if I was to have a chance of ever getting back together with the Rose. The irony was that while Kalinda De Vero placed no condition on Jack, the Rose would not be mine unless I played the game. She had to know my measure if I was to go with her. That at least was how I rationalized my decision and justified my fascination. In a sense, I was glad of Jack's situation. It meant I did not have to concentrate on my own. Soon we would be choosing characters, and I prayed to be accepted by Pearl Peru, to marry my soul to hers and become both a player and a piece in the game of time. I did not anticipate my fate at all, which was to be rejected by Pearl Peru and taken into the person of Captain Billy Bob Begg. It would strike me as a tragedy, a betrayal.